Okay, so legacy devices are going to be our history. In fact, they already are our history. But unlike my father's old slide rule, where we need to be able to preserve both the hardware and the software. Martijn is going to be telling us how he's been reversing the an old iPod Touch to produce a QEMU iOS version that will allow us to emulate these devices and keep them up to date, keep them, you know, usable into the future. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Martijn.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction. So, good evening, everyone. My name is Martijn, and I'm very happy to be here today to present my multi-year project, actually, on creating an open-source emulator of legacy Apple devices. And in this 30-minute talk, I will explain a bit about which device I emulate, how I emulate it, my philosophy behind it, my approach, and we talk a bit about the technical details. And this talk will particularly focus on the Apple Touch, which I believe is one of the most iconic devices that Apple has ever created. And this talk will focus on the Apple Touch first generation and the second generation. So a bit about myself. So I'm a postdoctoral researcher at EPFL in Switzerland. My main research focus is not in security, but it's more in distributed systems, where I focus on machine learning systems and the question on how to make them scalable and robust. But I'm also a reverse engineering enthusiast, and I've been doing this for many years. And also during my PhD, I managed to publish a paper that was about the reverse engineering of mobile banking implementations. So in this project, we reverse engineered a few mobile banks in the Netherlands, as well as in Germany and other countries, and we managed to automate money transfers. And this was before international money transfers became very quick due to PSD2 regulations, etc. So I first would like to talk a bit about my motivation for the project. I think in 2021, I was reading a blog post written by Jonathan Effek. And in his blog post, he described how he managed to emulate an iOS kernel with QEMU. And he managed to run it to an interactive bash shell. And I was reading this blog post, and he gave some technical details. And I was fascinated by that. And I was thinking, would it be possible to do that for other devices, and how difficult would it be to do it from scratch? Because his work, it was very great, but it used a lot of hacks and works around to get working. So I decided to embark on this journey, try to reverse engineer, understand these legacy devices, which I considered at the time a fun challenge. And I also wanted to contribute a bit to long-term hardware preservation, because I think it's really nice to have devices that are not produced physically anymore to still be able to emulate them with software. So where to start? And the first question that came to my mind is, which device should I emulate? I mean, over the many years that Apple has existed, they have created many different devices. And the contemporary devices, if you think about them, are extremely complicated. And as a consequence, they are very hard to emulate. So they have neural engines for AI workloads. They have Face ID, Touch ID engines, secure enclaves, which are very opaque and really difficult to understand and reverse engineer, but also software-matic security measures like trust caches, which is essentially a mechanism, a set of hashes that Apple considers trustworthy. So you can only run binaries that are in these kind of trust caches. So I was thinking, and actually my first Apple device was an Apple Touch 2G. And I thought, well, you know, let's go one step back and start with the first generation Apple Touch. That seemed that device was released in 2007, and it uses the ARMv6 instruction set. And I thought it was simple enough to emulate. Well, those were some famous last words, because this took quite a while in order to get up and running. You can see the device here on the right. So maybe you did own one at one point. But it got superseded by the Apple Touch 2G 1 year later in 2008. So I was not the first one to actually emulate these kinds of devices. The first serious attempt I could find was in 2012 by someone on Twitter called cmw.me. And he managed to emulate the S5L8900, which is the SoC of the Apple Touch 1G, as well as the iPhone 2G. And he managed to get some peripherals up and running, and he managed to emulate the boot ROM. Unfortunately, I couldn't get his code to run. So even though he did a lot of work on making some peripherals documented, it was a bit difficult for me to directly integrate it. And as far as I'm aware, this project and the person behind it, he also founded Corellium, which you might know as the commercial company that provides virtualized iPhone and Android devices. There's another work by Jonathan Effek, that was a blog post that I was referring to, and he managed to emulate an iPhone 6S Plus, as well as an iPhone 11 emulator by Trung. So they all have different, they all targeted different SoCs, different architectures, but none of them actually managed to get into the iconic user interface or get other components like the multi-touch up and running. I'll talk a bit about it later. And finally, you also have OpeniBoot. OpeniBoot is an open source bootloader for early Apple devices. It replaces the main bootloader, and it was originally used to boot into different operating systems, including Android, which would run, although very unstable, on the Apple Touch 2G. And I really learned a lot from all these projects, and I think I wouldn't have been able to carry out this project and get this far without like the help of all these projects and all the people behind this project. So I want to take this opportunity as well to thank everyone in the open source ecosystem that has contributed to these projects. So I'm very happy with them. Yes. So let's talk about this emulator. So I'm using QEMU for the emulation part, which is an open source framework for hardware emulation. With QEMU, you can define your machine, you can define the peripherals, and you can define the expected behavior once you start talking to these peripherals. It is a very convenient framework. It's also very well maintained, and it's very popular. It has integrated support for many popular hardware components, as well as protocols, including USB drivers, network interface controllers, SPI, R2C, SDIO, so all the kind of protocols you would need to create a device, an emulated device that you can actually use. So unfortunately, it has a very steep learning curve, so it is a bit difficult to get into, but by looking at other projects, the documentation is also rather, almost non-existent, but by looking to other projects and how they actually function, I was able to figure out a lot of things, and also, of course, through a lot of trial and error. And of course, during this emulation, I need a way to debug the binaries that are being emulated, because of course, it doesn't run out of the box. I cannot expect that if I emulate a binary, it will immediately load everything correctly. So I needed a debugger, and for that, I used TDB, and QEMU by default starts a TDB server. So it was very convenient to hook into this TDB server and be able to debug your binary. So you can see in the screenshot here that you're able to look at registers being filled, you can go through the instructions that helps to understand the program flow, you can step, you can set hardware watch points and breakpoints. So that was also very, very helpful in order to make progress in this project. And I've actually used this GDB a lot. I think this was my main debugging tool. And even though I am aware that you can write GDB plugins, it is very cumbersome, and it really relies on the particular image that you are using in order to get meaningful results out of that. And I need to understand binaries as well, right? Because I need to understand what happened, what kind of code is executed when running the emulator. I need to understand where things can go wrong and where the kernel, for example, hangs. And I reverse engineered all of this with Ghidra, or Ghidra, however you pronounce it. It is an open source tool created by the NSA and published by the NSA a few years ago. And it has support for many different architectures and instruction sets. In the screenshot here, you can see an example of the SPI controller, the start method, to be specifically. You can see the raw instructions, and you have the decompiled code on the right as well. And if you set your variables and you name your variables right, you can actually get pretty readable code that is very helpful in understanding how things work. So this shows the SPI controller, which is a key component because it also interacts with many different things. I'll talk about it a bit later in this presentation. But overall, it is a very awesome tool. Now, my philosophy during this emulation was that I want to stay as close as possible to the real hardware. I want to follow the code flow, exactly as Apple and as the architecture and the binary intend me to follow it. And the reason, so that means that I want to avoid relying on hacks, workarounds, image patching, kernel patching, whatever, because I was under the impression that this would really bite me later on. So you would work a bit on getting the device up and running. You would get further and further in the boot stage through like patching and disabling particular peripherals or disabling particular function jumps. But there is a very high probability that this will bite you later on. And I found many various occasions where, and I noticed that the interaction with peripherals get more and more involved as the device runs and the device boots. So it sounded like a good idea. However, the emulator in the end ended up with a bunch of hacks. Some of them were really unavoidable without very, very extensive work. Some of them were just out of laziness. So so I had a few workarounds, but I'm pretty sure that with future work, we can reduce the number of workarounds in these emulators. But most of the peripherals are actually there. So let's dive a bit more into the details, and I will now explain the boot chain, how exactly these older iPhones and iPod Touches are booting. And this boot chain is a bit involved. It contains various stages. It all starts with the secure on boot ROM, which is like the first stage, the very first code that actually runs on the device. It is a piece of code that is embedded in the device, so finding a vulnerability in here or a jailbreak in the iOS world is very much desirable because you cannot just easily patch this out. So the responsibility of that, of the boot ROM, is to load the first level bootloader, which is the low-level bootloader, or LLB. That bootloader loads the main bootloader, which is called iBoot. That iBoot loads the XNU kernel. The kernel then starts a process called launchd. This is the very first process and runs as superuser for Mac. And that launchd program eventually launches Springboard. And Springboard is the UI chef, and that loads the iconic home screen with all the applications in there. And from there, you can start other applications as well, like the alarm, Safari, your timers, your clocks, whatever. So my goal was to go beyond existing work and really go towards Springboard and be able to emulate third-party apps as well. So the boot ROM, let's start with the first part. So my initial intention was to start working on the boot ROM and get it up and running. And this, the main functionality of the boot ROM is basically to initialize some key peripherals, like a timer, like a clock, some controllers, a USB. And then it will either load LLB, the low-level bootloader, or it will put the device into DFU, which is a special restoration mode that allows you to restore the device through iTunes. So unfortunately, even though I was able to run a few instructions in the bootloader, I very quickly found out that it actually jumps to some unknown memory locations in the memory. And to date, I haven't really figured out what this code at this unknown memory location is, nor do I have access to this code. I could download the boot ROM actually from a website so that it's publicly available, but this piece of memory was not available to me. So I was a bit lost there, and I couldn't really continue, also since I didn't have a physical device at that time. So that was a bit difficult, and I suspect it has something to do with encryption-decryption logic, because in order to load the next binary, there is some verification going on, and some encryption and cryptographic operations. So then I decided, well, then let's start with low-level bootloader, right? So we can load the low-level bootloader into memory and start emulating that. Well, it has the same problem. It also jumps to these unknown memory locations. So that was also not very convenient to me, unless I start like guessing and implement these unknown memory locations, which at this point, I really had no idea, again, what they were actually doing. So then I decided to skip these two components, these two images, and go directly to the main bootloader, iBoot. And let's also look a bit at code. I'm going to show a few snippets later on as well. So in order to load with QEMU, you can just fetch the file from your host, from your host OS, and load it into memory. You put it into the RAM of the emulated guest device, and you set the program counter to the first instruction in that image. So then I was able to at least execute some parts of iBoot. And iBoot is mainly responsible for loading the kernel from the NAND flash memory from your file system. And if something goes wrong, it will start. It will go into recovery mode. And to understand this, I could download the binary, but I still had to decompile the binary. But it turned out that the iBoot source code actually got leaked in 2018. I was very lucky with that. So I don't know who leaked it, but the person that leaked it, I'm very grateful for them or team behind it, because it really helped me to understand some of the devices, and particularly the cryptographic engines that are actually in the device and how you can interact with them. So before I proceed, I would like to draw some attention to something called a device tree. The device tree, you might know it from Linux. It is basically a tree. It is a dictionary that contains all the peripherals, all the hardware that's in your device. And it also contains some properties of these hardware, like serial numbers or your MAC address or other important things that you would need during execution of the device. So you can see an example here on the right of the slide. This is the AES cryptographic engine. You can see some information about memory, about which interrupt controller manages interrupts, if it raises an interrupt, some name, some device type, an interrupt code, some other information as well. For this, I actually used the public device tree dump on GitHub as reference to see which kind of devices are there, and to also extract as much information as I could from these from this device tree. And now I was initially thinking, well, how difficult can it be to emulate this? Well, I recently made a diagram with only a subset of the peripherals that I emulated, and this is how it actually looks. So these, even though these devices are almost 15 years old, they contain many different controllers, many different hardware components that are all connected, most likely through a system bus, but some of these devices are also controlled through other different protocols, like for example, like SPI or I2C. So in order to get these peripherals up and running, I had to make sure that the controller was the associated controllers were working nicely as well. As I said, most of the hardware components actually are connected to the system bus, and you can interact with them. So the kernel, the CPU, interacts with these devices through something called MMIO. And MMIO stands for Memory Mapped I/O, and it essentially means that each device gets assigned a small part in the main memory. And if you write or read from an address in that memory, it will actually be handled by the device itself. So you can see here on the right, again, a subset of all the peripherals that I meant that were needed in order to get the full boot chain up and running. There are actually more than this, and there are also peripherals that I haven't even touched yet. But essentially, my task now boils down to understanding these peripherals, understand the registers behind them, and basically return the right value when for each register. So let's look a bit at how that is done with QEMU. So with QEMU, you first have to create a machine. I won't show the code for that, but assume you have a machine, you can then create the peripherals that are connected to that machine. And in this example, I'm showing how the system integrated chip is declared. This is a very simple component that simply contains some generic system information, like the version of the chipset being used, and I thought it had something like the time or something. So it is relatively simple. So what happens here is that I define a structure with the name of the device, the parent, which is like a system bus device. This signifies that it is connected to the system bus. I create a special struct which contains the state of this device. So using this structure called IppleTouch SysIC state, I can store some intermediate state and keep track of things that are going on in the device itself. And I declare some initialization methods, as both for the in particular instance that I'm creating as well for the class. And this is the part where things get really interesting, because I now have to define and implement many different callbacks for reading and writing to each of the registers of each peripheral. So at the top here, you can see the read method, which takes as input some opaque methods, which you can simply cast to the state object that that keeps track of the state of the hardware. I do that in the line below that. You get the offset of the register that you are currently reading, and you have some another size variable that I'm currently not using. Because I always know that the memory, I'm operating in 32-bit mode. So I always know that the value I should return can be at most 32-bit. So what I then do is, based on the offset, based on the address that I that this read method is called with, I have to do something, right? And in this case, if the power on control register is being invoked, I return a value of 42. Now, this value is I think, for presentation purposes, completely arbitrary, but I will show in the next slide that things can get complicated pretty quickly. So as you move on with emulation and you get more peripherals up and running, you also have to extend these kind of methods to return the appropriate values for particular conditions that you are in. Because ultimately, the value that you are returning depends on the current state of the peripheral as well as the register being, read. And below, you can see this almost the same write method. This is called when you write to a particular register. It also contains the value being written, and you can do some custom logic when particular registers are being written to. So this is an example of a bit more complicated method. This is the read method for the SPI controller. So in case you are reading from the R_RX data register, I am doing some logic. I am preparing a buffer. I'm preparing the device to return values that the kernel, that the CPU would expect. And the SPI particularly has taken me quite some time to get right, because there are very like tiny edge conditions and small things based on the word size, based on the buffer sizes in which you need to return something something different than you might expect. And finally, you can attach. You have to attach your peripheral, the hardware that you created, to the machine itself. What you do is you create an object. In this case, it's the you can see that in the second line, you create this peripheral. Store it somewhere in the third line. You create the MMIO region for that. After that, you can attach some interrupts to this particular device. And the code of the interrupt that you assign to a device should also match with the one that is declared in the device tree. So this is where the device tree has been tremendously helpful to understand the interrupt structure between all the different peripherals. So let's move a bit higher into the stack. So after the main bootloader has been, well, mostly running, I now had to emulate and make sure that the kernel runs. The main responsibility of the kernel, the first responsibility actually is to set up the CPU, to set up tasks, the task subsystem, and then it will actually start loading the device drivers. And it will load almost all the drivers that the device needs. And for this, it uses IOKit. IOKit is a framework by Apple that is used to write drivers. It is very well structured, so that was quite nice. It was that made it easier to understand what's going on. And starting a driver essentially usually involves writing to some configuration registers, resetting the device, clearing interrupts, cleaning up other data. So usually, like, my task was to, like, if a driver starts and it gets stuck somewhere or you get an error, trying to see what's going on, trying to understand the expected return code, trying to make sense out of that. Like, instead of just blindly returning the value that it would expect, I would try to look up on the internet. I would try to find data sheets in order to hopefully understand which register stores and controls what. And this was not always possible. Like, many of these peripherals that I'm working with are proprietary, but most of them follow a somewhat similar structure. You usually have some registers that are used for configuration, to read a status, to set some interrupts, to read interrupts. So sometimes you can make sense out of them, but some devices are quite difficult, as I will explain, I think, in two slides. So after all these drivers are loaded, it will actually start launchd, and then it will move to user land. So this was basically the task that I was stuck on for, I think, over a year. And after this year, I got most of the important peripherals fully functional. And that would include the clock, the timers, the vector interrupt controllers, the direct memory access controllers, and the cryptographic engines. So these are very important in order to get something, get to somewhere useful. And for some peripherals, I only have partial support. So I just have enough support to make it past the initial stage, to make sure that they load and that the kernel is happy with the state they are currently in. That includes peripherals like TV out, which triggers when you connect the device to through USB to a TV. The GPU as well, the accelerometer, and the light sensors, which are, I would say, not very critical for normal system operation. So about the GPU rendering, I was actually very lucky, and I was able to avoid rendering on the GPU by setting a particular flag, an environment variable to be specific. If that wouldn't have been possible, I would have to reverse engineer the communication with the GPU. So at that time, they were using a PowerVR MBX, which is completely proprietary, and as far as I'm aware, there has been no serious effort, at least public effort, to reverse engineer that. And I looked at the device, and it looks very complicated. So I was very happy that I could avoid that and instead rely on software-based rendering. So lots of work to do still. There are still many peripherals that are incomplete, but at least I'm very happy that at this point I could boot to user land. And one of the things I would also need to boot to user land is persistence. So it's during the boot sequence, the device would occasionally read from different kinds of memory, persistent memory, like the NOR and the NAND. They were actually quite different from between the IppleTouch 1G and 2G. So in a sense, the IppleTouch 2G has been like a revamp of the 1G, and they basically fixed, well, many of the mistakes, what they considered mistakes in the first generation, and did something else in the second generation. The main difficulty here is that how you actually store data on the hardware in the actual flash memory is completely different than how the operating system sees it. And I will show that in the next slide. And figuring out this particular mapping and how a particular like page is translated to some higher level entity took, I think, at least 2 months to figure out, especially for the NAND. which I will show a diagram in a moment. So I ended up creating a few scripts that convert a raw file system, as well as the images, and then prepares a NOR and a NAND memory that would be usable by the emulator that I have written. So just to give a quick impression of how this translation would work. So at the top here, you have the file system, which is HFS plus. And if it would request a block, some data from your flash drive, it is being addressed using LBA, logical block address. But this is not actually how it is stored and how the request goes to the actual underlying hardware. It will undergo different transformations by a layer called FTL and VFL. And then it will result in a physical page number as well, maybe some other information. So I had to understand this mapping and then create, basically do the reverse in order to create the proper file system. So the final, the most difficult, another difficult part here was the multi-touch. And even the multi-touch is a peripheral that is responsible for detecting touches and translating a touch into an XY coordinate. And even though this sounds like a very simple problem, it is actually a very difficult, both mathematical as well as a physical problem, because there are many complications when you touch the screen. And this was also evident in the code, because it has a very complicated initialization procedure. So the moment you would start this device, it would start calibration, it would upload some firmware. I found out it's using Sapphire 2, so it's some kind of embedded firmware that is has a firmware being loaded. And also, you can talk with it through SPI, and this is where SPI was really battle-tested and stress-tested. So I found several bugs in my SPI implementation, so I had to get it up and running before multi-touch would be happy. So far, I've done everything I explained without an actual device, but for this, I really required a real device, because everything that the code would do, I wouldn't understand. So what I did, I got gifted a real device by a friend, and I installed OpeniBoot, which is this open source bootloader, and then I talked to the device directly, and I would read out the frames, and I would play with a touch in order to understand different values that the device would return back to me. So after all this work, I was very happy to finally see the home screen being rendered. It will take, thank you. This was roughly in last year, October. This was the iPod Touch 1G, and I decided to immediately move on to the iPod Touch 2G because it has an SDK, and it also has better support for third-party applications, which is something where I wanted to go. And up to 2 months ago, I finally got that also up and running with iOS 2.1.1. So yeah, that also works now. And thank you again. And I combined all of this in the QEMU iOS emulator, which is an open source emulator. You can scan the QR code and you can go to the GitHub repository. It currently has support for the iPod Touch 1G and 2G. Compilation is a bit difficult though. It's mostly works on Mac, but I'm working on other OSs as well. And I'm currently focused on the stability of the iPod Touch 2G. And contributions are more than welcome, so feel free to create issues or reach out to me, maybe also after this talk. That's it for now. Thank you for your attention, and if you want to know more, you can either go to my GitHub or you can go to my personal website, where you can find some blog posts as well. Thank you. Yes, I can very quickly give a quick demo. Hopefully that works. So I'm not sure how visible it would be actually. So it now boots. So it goes to the bootloader, which is very quick. Then it goes to the kernel, and then I think after 20 seconds it boots. Multi-touch is also working, so I can use my cursor to control the device. I can press buttons. I can go back to the home screen, and I can also type some stuff as well. So overall, it is pretty functional. I still haven't installed third-party apps, but hopefully a volunteer here or a contributor can help me do this. So I think that's all for now.
Awesome, Martijn. So we have some time for questions. We have four microphones in the room, and we have a signal angel on the internet. Are there any questions? There, I see one on microphone three.
Hi, thank you for your talk. You mentioned something about frames in your debug screenshot. Maybe I missed it, but what is a frame in this context?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I actually prepared a slide for that. So let me go back to that. I think this should work. Yes, so if you talk to the multi-touch driver, it will give you back something called a frame, which is essentially a data structure that usually has other data structures in there. So in this case, this frame consists, I think, of three different layers. And at the lowest layer, you have a frame that has some information about a particular touch on the screen. It has like an XY, it has some velocity of how you move your finger, as well as a radius, like how big your finger is, and some depth. So I hope that answers your question a bit on what a frame is.
Thank you.
Question from microphone four.
Hi, great talk. I'm actually wondering about the SoC on those devices, because I presume it's Samsung. So I'm wondering if you had like found some public documentation about it, about interrupt controller and stuff.
The interrupt controller, yes, actually yes. Particularly in the interrupt controller is actually a VIC192, I think, or PL192. So this is actually a device that is very closely related to another documented device. So there were like some very tiny differences between these two that I had to figure out how were different. But some of them indeed were partially open.
Okay, and one more question, if you don't mind. Are you planning to upstream this to QEMU, or are you going to keep it in your tree?
What exactly?
Are you planning to upstream those changes to QEMU, or...?
Oh, upstream the changes. Oh, that's a good question. I haven't really thought about it yet. I don't know. I haven't really read into the policy of QEMU, so that would also depend on the developers there. Most of the code is very hacky, but then I looked at other examples in QEMU as well, and they're also, well, not the nicest code out there. So, yeah, maybe.
Okay, thank you very much.
Microphone one.
Thanks for the interesting talk. I would like to know what happened to those unexpected addresses, the boot sequence jump to you mentioned in the beginning.
Thank you for your question. So you asked like what happened to these unknown memory instructions.
Yeah, what did you do with those?
I actually found out later on in the kernel, yeah, I didn't really have time for that to go into more details. When executing the kernel, I actually found out there was again this jump to this memory location, although indirectly through the low-level bootloader, and that would like trampoline to another instruction. And but then, at that point, I had more context. So I was pretty sure it is related to the crypting the image, the firmware image. So as you might know, you have this IPSW file, which is like the main bundle, the main operating system for iOS. And all these files are encrypted. And at that time, they were using IMG2, which is like a horribly broken format right now. But that logic that you mentioned actually contained the decryption for that. So what I did, I used a workaround to patch that memory address, jump to QEMU, implement my decryption logic in C, and then put back the right decrypted image in memory. So that's how I circumvented this decryption.
OK, thanks.
Microphone two.
Yeah. Thank you for the great talk. I was wondering, you were mentioned Corellium before, which is a vendor providing virtual devices for Apple products, right? Apple doesn't really like their devices to be virtualized, which we could see from the 5-year-long lawsuit where Apple tried to sue Corellium.
Yes.
How do you see like the legality, or like, did you already receive a letter from the Apple lawyers or something?
Thank you for your question. No, I think I'm still too insignificant to receive any cease and desist any letters or something related to that. Talking about Corellium, I think it's pretty impressive what they managed to pull off, because emulating this kind of stuff is really, really difficult, and they have much more things going on, including Wi-Fi, jailbreaking, direct access to the raw memory, things I can only like dream of in my emulator, right? Because that would make debugging so much more difficult. I mean, to be fair, I don't think many people would care if like you emulate these legacy devices. The moment you start going to more recent devices, things would get more interesting. For example, I'm thinking about reverse engineering the Skewer and Clay for the neural engine. But again, these devices are, one, extremely complicated, and two, the decryption keys of the firmware is not public, so I have very little hope of actually moving beyond anything than, let's say, the iPhone X or 11.
And we have one final question from the internet.
Is there any work on the iPod Classic as well?
And there's what, Sam?
Is there any work on the iPod Classic?
Yes, there is. I think you have it's called Rockbox. It is an open source operating system and kernel for the iPod Touch Classic. It uses some similar peripherals. I think the vector interrupt controller and the DMA are similar. I actually talked with, I think it was half a year ago, someone was in Lausanne, where I live, and he dropped by, and we talked, and he worked on reverse engineering the iPod Classic and other older iPod devices. And he actually explained a lot about me, that the things that I didn't know, like how, about the storage thing. So yeah, I learned from them as well.
And with that, that's the end of our session. Could you join me in thanking Martijn on this wonderful talk and very important talk for the future?